From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Matthew Smith, in for Julie Glenn. It's being called an alternative to suspension. Restorative justice is transforming discipline and classroom culture in schools across Southwest Florida by avoiding punishments that take students out of the classroom and instead focusing on addressing the root causes behind bad behavior. Ahead, we'll talk with proponents of restorative justice in Florida schools and get some new data that school districts say proves it's helping students achieve. Plus, writer and environmental advocate Terry Tempest Williams is delivering two lectures in Southwest Florida this week. The author of 15 books, whose writing has influenced presidents and shaped environmental policy from Washington, D.C. to her home state of Utah, will talk about what she calls the open space of democracy. First, the news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Matthew Smith, in for Julie Glenn. Author Terry Tempest Williams is speaking at two engagements in South Florida this week. The first happened just this morning at FGCU. She's written 15 books, including When Women Were Birds and 2016's The Hour of Land, a personal topography of America's national parks. She also wrote in 2004 The Open Space of Democracy, the contents of which caused former FGCU President Bill Merwin to disinvite her from speaking at a convocation that year. Just this morning, she was welcomed to speak at FGCU, revisiting the concepts of the open space of democracy in the U.S. in the year 2017. Terry Tempest Williams, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's wonderful to be here.
It's great to have you. Thanks for coming. Let's start with your lecture this morning. It was about the open space of democracy revisited. You wrote that book in 2004, and here we are in 2017. Months after a major presidential election, the book was published months before a major presidential election. How has that open space changed in the last 13 years?
It's a great question. I actually went back to that passage that disinvited me here 13 years ago. And if we had substituted Donald Trump for George W. Bush, one would say very little has changed. But I thought about, okay, what has happened in this country in 13 years? What I realized was Facebook began in 2004, and so it was maybe 8 months old when I was here last. Twitter began in 2006. Fox News was, I think, 1998. It had only been 8 years. Now it's 20 years. Mm. So, and same with MSNBC News. So you begin to see the impact of segregated television with Fox News on one side, MSNBC on the other, that was in its infancy in 2004. Social media that now puts us in a collective frenzy, you know, second by second with tweets and Facebook posts, had just been started and hadn't been started yet. So I think the media landscape has changed. What has also changed is the urgency of climate. You know, in 2004, we were probably around 350 parts per million with carbon in the atmosphere. Mm. Now we're over 400. So I would say what's changed is our level of frenetic living and an accelerated climate on fire.
Hmm. It's interesting to hear you comment what's changed the most, and your thoughts immediately go to the media. And you know, as a writer, as somebody who writes about the environment and beautiful open spaces in Utah and Alaska, where you'll be hard-pressed to get a cell phone signal and to send out a tweet or update your Facebook page from those beautiful places. And yet the media is such a vital part of that open space for democracy.
It is, and I'm actually very active on Twitter. And, you know, maybe it's because I'm a bird watcher that I was first drawn, but it's an extraordinary political tool when used correctly. And it keeps us informed. It creates community. But I think the other side of it is it's distractive. It takes us out of direct experience. And I think what's very powerful right now is direct experience politically means being on the streets, protesting at the airports, and engaged in the kinds of powerful conversations that we're having, such as the one between you and I in this studio. I also think what's changed, Matt, is the power of marginalized people, that the power of personal identity, the voices that we're hearing from people of color, from women, from black people, brown people, you know, I know in the American West, from Indian people, that's where I'm taking my lead and very mindful of my own white privilege. And I think it's very important for us to be in the place of listening and really looking at a different kind of leadership. You know, I remember in 1994, I was in Mexico at a gathering called Grupo de Cien, and Brighton Breitenbach, who is a South African, was there, who fought on the side of anti-apartheid. And he said to me, "You Americans, you have mastered the art of living with the unacceptable." And I have never forgotten about that. And I think what we now in privileged white America have taken for granted, people of color have been living with all of their lives. And it is a wake-up call for us to rethink what engagement means, what solidarity means, and how we can be allies, following the conversation, not driving it.
I want to ask you about that that alliance, and there's so much to cover. You know, when we look back at the open space for democracy, you say that that open space is an area where the health of the environment equals the wealth of our communities. And when you talk about engagement, as you just were, here in South Florida, many people who come here, myself included, a transplant from another part of the country, they are coming here to inherit that environment, and it's new to them, and they may not even be aware of the Everglades in their backyard or the Estero Bay that they kind of drive by every day, but it might not be part of their experience when they live in Florida. So I think so much of your writing helps people connect with that place and understand its value. How do you make that value known to people who are newcomers to that environment? How do you begin that conversation with people who might not have been speaking up in that conversation before?
It's such a great question. I mean, this morning when my husband and I woke up this morning, we looked outside and what we thought were gulls, suddenly when our eyes focused, you know, here were a dozen white ibis. And you think, this is the gift of Florida. You know, I'm very aware that coming to this beautiful campus at Florida Gulf Coast University, this is on the edge of the Western Everglades. And, you know, for those of us that come from the desert, the Everglades is the closest thing we have to heaven. And, you know, I was here covering the BP oil spill. You know, certainly that got people's attention. I think so often what galvanizes us is loss. Whether it's loss of human rights, whether it's loss of free speech, whether it's loss of Estero Bay, as you speak, or in our case, the Colorado Plateau because of oil and gas drilling, that galvanizes people. And you're right. You know, people love the land, and especially our public lands, our national parks and monuments. I'm very interested that in my home state of Utah, our Congressman Jason Chaffetz, 2 weeks ago, introduced a bill in the House of Representatives to transfer / sell off 3.3 million acres of public lands in 10 western states. This morning, I woke up, checked my Facebook page, and lo and behold, there is Jason Chaffetz with a picture of himself holding his dog who said, "Today I will be withdrawing my bill to sell 3.3 million acres of public lands because I have heard you. And I too love hunting, fishing, watching birds, and these public lands." Now, that's the open space of democracy. What I know from people in his office is he has been absolutely flooded, phone lines shut down, because people all over the country have cried foul, no pun intended, that you will not sell off our public lands, that our public lands are our public commons, and this is our national inheritance. It is our collective identity. Hmm. You threaten to take that away from people, and they're going to rise. And that's what we're seeing now. I think that the Trump administration and Congress people like Jason Chaffetz in my hometown and Rob Bishop have overreached and overstepped, and they are going to hear from the American people. Last year was our centennial year of the National Park Service. Over 300 million people visited them. They anticipate numbers to rise again. I love, who would have ever imagined, Matt, that our Park Service, the green and gray with their straight-rimmed hats, would have gone rogue when President Trump.
By rogue, I think referring to those alt National Parks accounts on social media.
Absolutely. When they shut down and froze public information on climate, you know, Badlands National Park became Badass National Park and immediately fast-fired four tweets on carbon parts per million, 400 and rising.
I think there's a lot to unpack in those comments, and I do want to just circle back to one of the things you mentioned before, that sense of when a public space, when public lands and resources are threatened. You are here at FGCU speaking in the name of Rachel Carson. And Rachel Carson, of course, famously spoke up against damage to the environment. A lot of people credit her with sweeping changes to the nation, including some people credit her with the advent of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. What are your thoughts about having your work and your writing linked with a legacy like Rachel Carson's?
I can't imagine it because she is my hero and a mentor. I continue to read her. What she made look so easy came with a great cost. I'm sure many of the listeners were able to see the beautiful film that was just made on her that was shown on PBS, The American Experience. I think one of the things that touched me so much is that at the end of her life, she was dying of breast cancer. It had metastasized. She knew that Silent Spring was heard. She knew that President Kennedy had read it, that there were now hearings that would give rise to the EPA, as you suggest. And what she said to her friend, Dorothy, before she died was, you know, I am at peace because I realize I have done all I could do on behalf of the birds and the animals and this place we call home. And it really made me think about, could I say that if I were to die tomorrow? I don't think I could. And I think Miss Carson reminds us over and over again, how serious are we? And what are we willing to give our life to? She gave her life to the integrity of the natural world. A woman who was completely in love with the natural world, especially the ocean and nature in general. She knew the power of language. She knew the power of metaphor. She knew that if she was going to be talking about DDT and the dire effects, the long-term effects of pesticides, rather than simply saying that and writing a polemic, if she could create an image in a town where suddenly there was no birdsong, it was a silent spring, that gets our attention. If my writing could, in the smallest of ways, contribute to that kind of attention and heart grace to give voice to those who literally have no human voice, but certainly their own voices of integrity, then I would be very humbled.
Former President Bill Clinton was authorizing the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in Utah. He held up a copy of one of a collection of work that you edited, Testimony, which you, I believe, Steve Trimble edited. He said this helped holding that book when he made that dedication. Do you feel like your writing, is that an example, do you feel? Does it have the effect of what you're hoping to inspire a president to make that monument?
I think the power of testimony was not in one person's voice, but it was in a community of voices. And that book held dozens of voices of individuals who loved Utah's wildlands, and in this case, fighting for the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. A similar effort has been made from Torrey House Press with another group of people creating a Red Rock testimony on behalf of Bears Ears National Monument. Now, 1996 was Grand Staircase National Monument, that little book may have contributed. 2016, President Obama established the Bears Ears National Monument, and we have word that it's possible that President Trump will sign an executive order to undo that action. Again, that will be an overreach, and I can promise you there will be outrage, beginning with the tribes. The Bears Ears Intertribal Commission that consists of the Navajo Nations, Hopi, Zuni, the 2U Nations, they will fight this. Russell Begay, president of the Navajo Nation, said, Bears Ears National Monument is all about Indian sovereignty. This would be a racial assault. And from a president who has a portrait of Andrew Jackson behind his desk, in the West, we know Andrew Jackson is, quote unquote, an Indian killer. That would not come as a surprise. But this is what we're up against. And I'm sorry I'm using harsh words. My voice is trembling. I respect that I am in a county that is largely Republican. But this does not have anything to do with right, left, or center. I think it has everything to do with our public lands and what we have to protect and preserve in the name of love.
We are speaking with Terry Tempest Williams, author and environmentalist who spoke at FGCU this morning. She'll be speaking again tomorrow evening on Sanibel. Give us a call. Ask her your questions. Share your thoughts. 877-428-8255, or that's 877-GCU-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU. So much of your writing, Terry, has to do with identifying that sense of place and extolling its virtues and making it very personal. And through writing about it personally, you can help other people connect with it. It's something, you know, before I went to the deserts of Utah, I had read one of your books, and it primed me to engage in that environment, that landscape. So I have to refer back to your comments earlier about the way we seem to be fractured, but also united when it comes to media, social media in particular, and the way that we have political divisions that run deep, but you also say this is not about left or right or Republican or Democrat. How do we find, in a very polarized time, how do we find a common ground, a common space where we can leave maybe hard, you know, what we perceive to be very firm political divisions behind and focus on something as concrete, the pun is kind of inescapable there, as concrete as common land and public spaces, things like that?
That is the question, isn't it, Matt? When I say it's not about Democrat, Republican, left, right, or center, I think what I'm really talking about, it's about worldview. Is the earth for our taking? Or is it a place of residency where we have certain responsibilities to maintain in the name of reciprocity? And it's that split that I'm seeing. Yes, it could be argued, you know, we are a country divided, that the Civil War has never ended. But I think it's deeper than that. I think it's really a global view of what is the role of technology. It's a religious view. Are we just waiting to get to heaven, or is Earth enough? And that's where I think it gets that's what I think about. You know, how do we go to this deeper level, and what does unite us? And this summer I had the pleasure and privilege of visiting 20 national parks, and I never heard Republican or Democrat mentioned, even though we were in the middle of a presidential debate. What I heard was, isn't this a place of awe, or have you ever seen the Grand Falls like this, you know, that was 15 miles from Washington, D.C., where the Potomac, you know, cascades in this Mather Gorge, or, can you believe Yellowstone? Can you believe how faithful Old Faithful really is as the masses gathered around and watched this geyser erupt 20 stories high? Or, you know, Yosemite, to be able to witness El Capitan at sunset or the Grand Canyon at sunrise. You know, these are the geographies that create us, that create our identity as a country with varied stories in all of them. And I love how, you know, our national parks aren't just our best idea, but an evolving idea that on one minute can be Bears Ears National Monument led by the tribes of 1.35 million acres to the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Historic Park or Stonewall, to think about the struggle and vitality of the struggle of...
And Stonewall being so new, I think we have to interject here and remind listeners that Stonewall, of course, we're talking about the bar in New York City where many say the fight for LGBT rights kicked off.
Exactly. And I think President Obama particularly has broadened the notion of what our national parks and monuments and historic sites can be. You know, I love that a black president... who was a community organizer, in 2012 honored another community organizer named Cesar Chavez and created the Cesar E. Chavez National Monument. Dolores Huerta, his partner in the farm workers' fight, also honored. You know, it expands all of us. And I think this is what we're honoring. This is what we are fighting for. And this is part of our national identity and shared history.
Just want to interject a quick comment here from Facebook. We have Lucia from Naples saying, thank you, Terry. You are not alone in this country. She got in touch with us by reaching out on Facebook. That's we are at WGCU Public Media. You can also try us on Twitter. We're at WGCU. And you can also give us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK.
I so appreciate that. Thank you.
Terry, we... Again, I feel like when we talk about, you know, finding that common ground, that place where we can come together and have a dialogue and have disagreements, here in South Florida, as you mentioned, it's an area of the country that has been red for decades. It's been voting for Republican congressmen and senators and presidents.
It's very much like Utah.
Going back to Nixon, yeah. And you will also find those same voters out at Big Cypress National Preserve, the Western Everglades.
Sure.
Out there, your fellow birders, marveling at nature, at our environment, and also noting the delicate balance that it stands in as Florida develops faster and faster and becomes one of the most populous states in the country. So I envision Terry Tempest Williams standing out there looking through binoculars right next to people who are loving and appreciating the environment and may have been voting very differently or having very different political goals at the polls, I guess, at the ballot box this past November. So I feel like I may be circling
that
this question
again. That
would
be my family, just so you know, Matt. So this is very familiar territory to me. And
with so much in common, how is it so difficult to find the common ground and to bridge that gap of ideology when we are marveling at the same beautiful environment?
I think we have to talk to each other. And I think, you know, loss is a great motivator. I look at my own father, who would be the poster child for this kind of evolution that you're talking about. He's the Marlboro man with the cigarette who wears cowboy boots that could kill spiders in corners, you know.
That's the father you credit as being your hero in many of your
books.
He
is my hero. And we both have changed because we're family, you know. But he marched 2 weeks ago in St. George, Utah, one of the most conservative places you will ever find in America. He marched with his partner because he feels that as a Republican, a lifelong Republican, the Republicans have gone too far, that President Trump is not listening, and that even our governor in Utah and our congressional delegation are mute to the voices of the people. So I think extremism is a great motivator. And when you get the extreme right and the extreme left, you have a common middle center of the country that is saying, where is the common sense here? We love our commonalities. We believe that there should be health care for all. We believe that our public lands should remain public. And I think this is where we begin to have common ground. Brooke and I live in a small desert hamlet, Castle Valley, Utah, and we have taken to have what we call difficult dinner parties. Maria Rocha said, how about calling them healing dinner parties? That's a better name for them, I think.
Well, I like that alliteration, though, difficult dinner parties.
But what we have is we have 12 seats around our dinner table. We have invited people that do not agree, and they have been wonderful. Why? Because we open the door and we say, welcome. The lights are low, candles are lit, there's good food, Brooke is the cook, and we break bread together. And yes, at times it's uncomfortable, but there's a form. It's a dinner party. There are manners, and people listen to one another. And I think when we leave, we realize there's much more that binds us together than separates us. And we don't get an opportunity because I think not only is our media segregated, and not only do we spend so much time on social media alone and isolated, we don't get a chance to really just sit down and say, tell me how you feel and why do you feel that way? And when we are eye to eye in an intimate space with good food and friends in a neighborhood, suddenly you think, wow, I can hear what you are saying. And although I disagree, I appreciate your point of view. It begins there. So I think these parallel paths, find a convergence in unexpected ways.
So the open space for democracy is the dinner table.
It has been for our family, and that's where I've taken my cue. You know, in the contentious dinner parties that we've had around the Tempest household, I don't think I've seen anyone that got up and stormed out. Although we would have liked to, we stayed around the table. And we began with prayer, and we ended with hugs. And, you know, sometimes it hasn't always gone well. Sometimes it's ended badly, but we keep returning.
Hopefully that that is a challenge to listeners across our region, whether they're hearing this and nodding their heads in agreement or shaking their heads at some of the things they hear. They can invite those neighbors to the dinner table and find that common space and talk with one another.
The open space of democracy is a discussion about civil society. And I think it begins with being civil. And I think one of the most painful things for me watching this last election was how uncivil it really was. And so I think we have to restore manners. We have to go into that place of listening and regard and then fight for those things that matter to us. And for me, it has always been land, people, community, even beyond our own species, both human and wild.
Terry, we've barely touched all the stuff I wanted to talk about, but I just want to say thank you very much for coming into our show today.
Bless you, Matt. Thank you.
Terry Tempest Williams will be speaking once more in Southwest Florida tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at St. Michael and All Angels Church on Sanibel Island. We have links and all the information you need on our website, wgcunews.org. Thanks, Terry, for coming in today. Our show was produced by Matthew, by myself, and my partner in crime, Julie Glenn. It was directed by Kevin Trueblood. Our social media coordinator is Tarek Halligan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Thanks for listening. I'm Matthew Smith, in for Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.